Not Abbott and Costello. Inspired by The Mummy, what monster should next join Universal's Dark Universe, and who should play it or them?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Phantom of the Opera, who is part of the Universal Monster Universe, and he will be played by Hugh Jackman, who will sing all of his dialogue.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm also going with the Phantom of the Opera, but I think it should be played by Emily Blunt, because what? Man, Phantom of the Opera.
She was lame. In the Wolfman. Don't forget.
Whoa.
No, that's not part of the universe anymore.
The Twitter eggs are going to light up at the suggestion of reverse gender casting. Oof.
Not the Phantom of the Opera, our straightest of straight icons.
The Phantom of the Opera was written as a man, and it should continue to be a man. It was written as a man. I'm now trying to figure out who wrote The Phantom of the Opera. Do you know? The French novelist who wrote
Not
The Phantom
Andrew
of the Opera?
Not Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Gaston Leroux. Huh. Gaston Leroux wrote it as a man. I'm sorry. I should get back to my answer. I'm Matt Patches, and my monster is the Creature of the Black Lagoon, played by Leonardo DiCaprio in the blockbuster that set in the wake of pulling out of the Paris Agreement. It's a real eco-thriller.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 169. It's Wednesday, June 7th, and on this day in 1955, President Dwight Eisenhower, now that's a real president there. He had accomplishments and stuff. And he was the first president to ever appear on color TV. And really, once we put one president on television, that's kind of how we got to our current nightmare. So,
what do you think the next big
job,
medium
Dwight.
Will be for a president to appear on that will become trivia worthy of this day in
I
history.
Remember Obama doing a Reddit AMA, and that was a big deal. And being on Twitter.
Generations of the future. Yeah, the first presidential tweet is worthy of the history books. Maybe presidents on VR, whatever
no,
that's going to be.
No, VR is definitely going to be it. It's going to be like, watch the inauguration from on stage.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of cool. Totally I would watch that.
Through your Google cardboard.
Oh, boy. Okay. Great. So we have David on this week, just not currently at the moment. He's a little scattered as he prepares for his wedding. But I'm sure David will be delighted to know that our exhortations from last week to have reviews from New Zealand totally paid off. Thank you, New Zealand. Patches, read us these amazing reviews that New Zealand really stepped up with.
Yeah, I'm going to speed through these four New Zealand reviews. Thank you to everyone who left 5 stars all across the board. Very, very nice. Thank you. The first one is from Catherine Rich. Damn, I have been shamed into writing this review. I have been listening since the Op Kino days and have still never found a film podcast as good as this one. The hosts are all very knowledgeable and they discuss a good range of movies. They have very different opinions, and even if you disagree with one of them, at least one of the others will be on your side, so it's not too frustrating. Also, the musical transitions are great. I would like to include a bit of Patch's love. I started listening to this podcast in high school, and I think David has influenced my film taste a lot. Ugh. But lately, I have been really enjoying Patch's strange humanist opinions. He tends to bring up the most interesting ideas. I also liked Warcraft, even though I fell asleep in the theater during it. thanks for the great podcast. Thank you for the love.
Oh, my God.
It warms my heart, my humanist heart.
All right, what's next?
Yes, okay. Subject, more shame. From Kiwi Hobbit number 5742.
Yes.
It simply says, this is also a review. next we have, fine, here's your stinking review from MC Bidoy. In amongst the many movie podcasts that currently inhabit my AirPods, including Film Spotting, How Did This Get Made, We Hate Movies, Blank Check, The Next Picture Show, and The Canon, who all owe us money now. Fighting in the War Room offers a point of difference that ensures it doesn't get lost amongst the review with you. Fighting! The frequent differences of opinion make for multifaceted discussions that present multiple ways of looking at popular culture. Even if I don't agree with all of the viewpoints, I agree with the passion. My one bugbear. Bugbear? Is that a New Zealand phrase? I'm going to have to look that one up.
I would think it'd be bugaboo, but I want to know more about
bugbear. That's written as one word. Interesting. Can we all actually record in the same war room? The numerous instances of delayed responses and crosstalk in almost every episode at a level of unnecessary frustration. I'm sure for the listeners as well as the hosts. Well, MC Bidoy, it's not possible. Well,
but stay tuned for next week's episode.
Yeah, next week we're actually gathering for David's wedding, and we'll record something. Something will happen.
Yeah.
You guys did that during my wedding, and it was quite a treat. I don't know if it was
the day after, not during your wedding.
It was not during it, true. The aftermath. You all lived.
We did.
Last review here.
It's only through the grace of my editing that parts of your wedding didn't actually go in that episode, by the way.
I was like, maybe
something just for the guests.
But yeah, apologies whenever we crosstalk. You know, we do this from different parts of the American map, and we're trying to get better about not talking over each other. Faster Wi-Fi. Yeah. Blame Google or something. Last review, a humble review by Mr. Knight, Mr. Ice Guy. Frankly, I never thought you would check the New Zealand iTunes page. David, you caught us out. But to defend ourselves here, us Kiwis are a humble species, and we needed that extra encouragement to write a review that may be read on the air. I used to be a no-good TV reviewer like Joanna Robinson. Still am, but your podcast has gotten me into films I might have never seen otherwise. Thank you, Katie, Dave, Patches, and David for making me a better human. As a token of my gratitude, if any of you come down to Wellington, be sure to check out the wonderful Embassy Theater, where we can watch a film together that was screened a month or more ago in the U.S. Right now, you can see such highlights as John Wick Chapter 2. Yes, that's the cinema that held the 2003 red carpet premiere of Return of the King. But forget Lord of the Rings. Now, all we're known for is John Oliver making fun of us. Please do your John Oliver impressions again, because I need more of that in my life. Shame on you. Shame on you, John Oliver. There you go.
That was so much more successful than I could have dreamed. And Patches, I wish we hadn't told you that we asked New Zealand to step it up and you just had to read all these and figure out why they were all shamed into reviewing
us. Got all these New Zealand reviews. They just love it. They just discovered us there. It just came over from, see it's the delay.
Like John Wick 2.
Yeah.
I don't know which country to target next, but clearly this is a good strategy. So if any of you guys are in other countries and you notice that your country's iTunes reviews are especially empty, tweet at us and we'll get going. And everyone and anywhere, please leave us a review. These are great. By the gap, bother, I'm your sign. I'm used to living on the other side.
We've talked about this on the show once before, but I play, and I know Patches plays, and I don't think Katie remembers, a game called Hearthstone, Heroes of Warcraft. It's a digital card collecting, deck building game where you sign onto the app, either on your computer or on your phone. They have a mobile app, and you get cards that each have powers, and like Magic the Gathering, you play against another person and try to climb either a ladder or earn prizes to get more cards to make more exotic decks or more powerful decks. It's slightly more simple than Magic the Gathering, or at least was when it began. Hearthstone's now several years deep into existing, 2 years deep into what it calls its themed years, where each year they narrow the competition, because there are now official Hearthstone competitions. They narrow the competition's deck cards that you could use to a certain number of sets, and other ones have been deemed quote-unquote wild decks, which means you could use even cards that were deemed too overpowered. Anyway, because it is a active game, and because they release new cards every couple of months, Hearthstone's actually at its highest daily users right now that it's ever been, which means that's consistently showing growth throughout different expansions. And I, at least, have found it more fun. The last time we talked about it on the podcast, they just released an expansion that Patches thought maybe had broken Hearthstone for him, because there was a whole bunch of superpowered cards that sort of limited play within the first 10 turns, a whole bunch of technical things. But since doing that single podcast episode, I have been playing it, you know, basically daily, for like a break, unless I'm, you know, on vacation or something, and amassed a whole bunch of friends that have heard our podcast segment, and I could, play them online or get different bonuses for watching them win games, or just sort of chat about how I'm too busy to do stuff. But for me, Hearthstone has continued to be engaging as a free-to-play experience. But I just heard from Patches off air that he, after giving it a break, checked in and is thinking about giving it up. What about the current Hearthstone experience is so much worse for you, Patches?
It's not that I'm thinking about it. It's that I really have. I don't think I've really played in maybe a month or two. And I occasionally go back on because you can play games and have loved ones watch you play. And if they watch you, they get cards. So my wife is still obsessed with Hearthstone. And I do it for her reward. I'm a great
Wait, husband. How does it work that she watches you? Like, she logs into the app and it shows that she's watching you?
You can see when your friends are on, and I'll occasionally pop into Dave's games and watch him lose.
Wait, can I... So, in your home, how does this plan it? So, you guys are both sitting there next to each other on your phones, like, separately watching the same game?
Occasionally, yes. Yes.
Okay, this is not a judgment call. I have
Sounds
done this...
Sounds shamey.
We have spent plenty of time in our house looking at our phones and not speaking to each other and not playing the same game, so this sounds better, probably.
But I'm here to... say that this is I've reached a set time in my play because I'm not really engaged with that anymore. And I think even if you don't play Hearthstone, that this is an interesting conversation because here is something that's gunned to grow and to be more interesting. And as Dave said, it's got to phase certain parts that maybe didn't work. It's an ever-changing game, just as Magic the Gathering was. If you were a kid of the 90s playing Magic, or an adult of the 90s playing Magic, I shouldn't be ageist here, many adults
That's
play
right.
Magic the Gathering, you know, they were constantly phasing out cards and adding new expansions, and that's how collectible card games worked. And that's how a lot of games work in terms of, like, DCPs with video games, and they... want to be giving new experiences for the things that you invested in and purchased long ago. And Hearthstone is the same way, except that for me, these games have become so big and so rapid that with months, I think there were like 2 months leading up to this big development, right, Dave? Like, they were prepping for this for a while and publicizing it.
Oh, you're talking about the new cycle.
Yeah, like you could go on a site like Polygon or Kotaku and get rundowns of the cards that were going to come and the new abilities, so you could prep for this. I did not have time to invest. Even though I played a lot of Hearthstone, I just couldn't find myself grappling with the new concepts that were being introduced. They're a little more complex. I don't know. I wasn't prepared for the Switch. And then you have this kind of devastating moment, at least from my perspective, where the whole game changes. You have to rebuild everything. So you have these decks that you've taken time and built. And then suddenly half of the cards are unusable and you have to redo all the work. It's work to play this game. And I wonder, I'm more interested in hearing from listeners on Twitter or Facebook or fightingtheworm.com or whatever about other games that are like this, where these monumental changes have happened to the infrastructure of the game so that you've completely lost interest. I didn't think it would happen to me with Hearthstone because I played it quite a bit. And here you have these, you know, challenge cards and just like it became so complex and I just couldn't put in the work. Maybe I'm getting too old. I don't know what's wrong with me.
If you went and played one of your old decks, you're saying you just get murdered because...
Well, I wouldn't be able to play a lot of my old decks because they used cards that are no longer available. So I'd have to rework. I'd have to learn every single card, what they do, so that my deck can kind of function in a strategic way. Or I'd have to cheat, in my opinion, and like look up types of decks that people have pre-built and written about online. I'd have to do the work to actually get in the game and start playing it. I'm more of a casual gamer. And when I play these games, even though I don't have the best decks, I'll still go in and play with them because I just want to have a good time. I just want to be able to play. That's how I just got an Xbox One and I was playing Star Wars Battlefront for the first time. I'm like a little behind the curve here, obviously, but I'm bad at it. But I don't care. Like, I just want to play and get shot up and who cares? I don't want to take it super seriously. I want to be a casual gamer. But a lot of these games, they demand your commitment. Like, Dave constantly wallops me when we play Hearthstone together because you, Dave, are on top of the strategies. You know all the card abilities. Your brain works in that way. And this has been my gaming life forever. You know, I grew up playing Warcraft and Starcraft. And, you know, Korean kids who were up at like 3 a.m. their time were kicking my ass every night because it's just like I can't put in the time to learn all the strategies and make it a mathematical type of thing or an analytical. I'm just too casual about it. And
but now
this game has become analytical.
So it's the game has changed to a degree that it hadn't before so that you can't keep up.
Yeah. And like, because I wasn't prepared for the change, suddenly I don't have the time to like go back and really rebuild and study and create a deck that I could even get in and start playing with. And luckily, Hearthstone actually has an ability. It has games for people like me. They have a section that's like, here, we'll just hand you a deck and it's going to be a silly game with some sort of twist and you can play something pre-built against people. And that's basically what I do when I need to win cards for my wife, Michelle, because I don't have any decks that function. I've been phased out of the game. I just think it's really... It's not surprising to me, and it's not Blizzard, the company behind Hearthstone's job, to make this work for me. It's just lost me, and it's kind of sad.
I mean, it's interesting for me because as somebody who was engaged with the game, I had a real hard time with the past year before this new expansion because I feel it was railroading play into this style or that style. And I think like even though they're more... options that were opened up in this new version of the game, and it might seem sort of overwhelming for me as somebody who's been following it, the overall result is that it's closer to what it was back when we started.
Well, do you think it's more like, chaotic now? Because I feel like when we were complaining about the last expansion, they had created a game where people who can picture decks working in total tandem together, like a deck that its entire purpose is to get to one card so that it will totally destroy you. That's what worried me. And they created, you know, they changed the rules of certain cards and tried to roll it back a little during the rollout and maybe corrected some of that, those errors. But now maybe this pack is, or this expansion has made it more chaotic. And that's actually what games should do to level the playing fields, put things in there that are just total wild cards.
I think that it's easier to get to a deck that you could play semi-competitively than it was in the past like year. So like these are all going to be terms that don't mean anybody. But you could have like a basic hunter deck that doesn't have any legendaries in it and still get to like 14 or 13 in the current meta because mid-range hunter has been rebalanced against like, you know, warlock with a Reno that would just like suddenly get all its health back. So I feel like it's something there. But what you're saying is totally true in that a lot of these free-to-play games that are based on grinding and then also have like a sort of side competitive bent just get super competitive over time as like the casual people fall off, which is why I've been so surprised that Hearthstone's daily user base has actually been going up. So even if you wanted to queue into, you know, like wild games, presumably there's still someone there that wants to play your wild deck.
And I think I am not someone who has spent a dime on the game. I have done a lot of grinding to like get money to pay for the different stuff, but all in game. I've never spent a dollar, I don't think they want people
on
like
my
me.
Birthday one year.
You did? What a treat. Katie's like, what the fuck are you guys talking about?
No. I feel like, you know, when you go like to the doctor's office and they talk about all this stuff in a language, you're like, I know that means something. You sound very smart. I don't know. I enjoy.
Yeah, this is less complex than healthcare.
I don't know how
in
do you guys
America.
Have time for this?
When do we have time? In the late hours.
I guess so.
And bathroom, anytime in the bathroom.
Yeah, like doing that instead of reading Twitter.
Those nights when you were up with Charlie trying to get him to go to sleep or having him lay on you in like 3 a.m. in the morning, you could have whipped out your iPhone and been playing Hearthstone.
I know. I was on Twitter instead. It was terrible.
Yeah, that's
while we're waiting for everyone to get seated at David's wedding, we'll install you on Hearthstone and we'll give you a run through.
And I think the key thing to wrap this up is that I, even though I feel like I've been kicked out of Hearthstone or that I'm like the kid in sixth place, like struggling running to catch up, I think new people could dive in much easier than I could because I'm stuck in my ways. And that if you were brand new to the game, you have a leg up as long as you are willing to spend a bit of cash to like buy cards the way you would Magic the Gathering.
Dave, do I have to spend cash to get started?
I mean, I'm interested as an experiment to see if you're interested in a free to play model just as for myself. I don't think you'd need to. I think I could make you a pretty good mid-range hunter deck like 5 decks in.
Don't forget that I played an hour of old school World of Warcraft or just Warcraft and enjoyed it. So
don't forget that Katie's son's middle name is Gul'dan.
That's true. His middle name is Gul'dan. It was a blood oath I made to this podcast.
So many blood oaths on this podcast.
Show me how this works. I will be intrigued as a, I mean, I have played a lot of dumb games on my phone, and none of them with, you know, that are engaging on this level. So why not?
You could, because when we wake up on Sunday and we're like, oh, we forgot we said we were going to record a podcast today. Now we have something to do.
Instead of just telling stories about who got drunk at David's wedding.
Outing everybody.
Yeah. The answer will be me. I won't have a baby with me. It's going to be great.
It's getting kind of hard to believe things are going to get better. I've been drowning too long to believe that the tide's going to turn. And I've been living too hard to believe things are going to get easier now. I'm still trying to shake off the pain from the lessons I've learned. And if I see Van Helsing, I swear to the Lord I will slay him. Ha 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 ha, he'd take it from me, but I swear I won't let it be so.
So this mini segment we're devoting, there's going to be a lot of talk at David's wedding, I think, in the near future, since we'll all be in one place for the blessed event. But David, since you will not be joining us on the episode devoted to your wedding, I wanted to use this segment as an opportunity to talk about it. And what better way to talk about your wedding than to quiz you on Forgetting Sarah Marshall? Because Ooh. This is how we indulge you.
If I can't pass a Sarah Marshall quiz with flying colors, then I do not know what I've been doing with the last 10 years.
I wish I had prepared a Forgetting Sarah Marshall
trivia quiz. An actual quiz. Okay. This is a figurative quiz.
I just wanted to give you a chance to like talk about why this movie for you is like the standout. I assume it is like your favorite Judd Apatow universe movie.
I don't know. There are a lot of contenders. I happen to think I'm currently in the middle of writing an article about why Funny People is a misunderstood masterpiece.
Oh,
I 40-year-old version, I think, is a formative movie, not just for me, but for, I think, sort of the comedy landscape in the 21st century. Knocked Up is as rewatchable a movie as has ever been made. And then Step Brothers, which I don't know off the top of my head.
That's tangential Apatow, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if he really has his input.
Get him
on
to
it,
the Greek?
Get him to the Greek. The Greek is not as not in the top tier, I'm afraid.
Why don't we talk about rubbing the fuzzy wall, or whatever that line is from Getting to the Greek.
The Peter, or whatever, not the Peter, the... I've only seen Get Him to the Greek a few times.
There's that shag wall.
But the drug
Something
they
about
take.
The fuzzy wall.
We should be gifting that wall take. Every day. Good joke.
I can't remember what the name of the drug is. The cocktail of drugs. But Forgetting Sarah Marshall is a movie that I've seen. I cannot even imagine how many times. I couldn't begin to count. And it really started because...
You love Jason Segel's dong.
Because I love Jason Segel's dong.
And you heard.
And I would just follow it wherever it happens to go. And
it points, you follow.
Exactly. It was love at first sight at that screening of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and we've been together ever since. No, this is one of those movies that is on television at all times. At any given time, it's on one channel, whether it's on premium cable or basic cable. When they play it on basic cable, you're like your FXs or your CWs, whatever the case might be. They play it with additional scenes that were cut out of the movie, one involving Kristen Wiig in a yoga studio. And then, you know, it's always on HBO 7 or whatever the case might be. And it was playing on a constant loop when I used to live with my two oldest friends and when I started dating my now fiance, imminent wife. And it would just always be on the TV in our apartment. And suddenly it became a thing with us all just shouting Dracula musical at each other. But to this day, I will say that this is much more than simple nostalgia for a time not long past. That movie is a fucking masterpiece. Like, there is not a single line in the movie, and there are many, many, many lines in this movie that is not in some way deeply hilarious to me. And one of the things, you know, this is low on the list of reasons that I love my fiance, but it's on there all the same. Is that she feels the same way, and we can more or less communicate in quotes from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And you heard it here first, although I hope that not too many people who are going to be at my wedding are listening to this. There will be, as all of my fellow podcast hosts already know, a prominent reading from the book of Forgetting Sarah Marshall during my ceremony.
Well, so, what is your choice Forgetting Sarah Marshall quote exactly as we wrap this up? How would you profess love using Forgetting Sarah Marshall quotes?
If it were me curating the IMDb quotes page for Forgetting Sarah Marshall, I would just upload a PDF of the entire script and sort of walk away
from
the
computer.
You would
suck at that then.
That would be a bad... You would be bad at your job.
I would suck at that. It would still be better than most of the curation in IMDb. But the... It's so hard to say, but beyond simply Dracula's Lament, the song that he plays at the Hawaiian bar, I definitely have a soft spot. I mean, all the throwaway lines from that movie are ingrained in my brain, but I have a soft spot for the scene where they're talking in sort of oblique terms about Pulse, what the fuck is her name? Veronica Mars, help me out here.
Kristen Bell?
Not the character's name. Thank you.
The horror movie that she's in?
In my head, she's Sarah Marshall. But they are talking, they're sort of mocking her for this movie that Sarah Marshall supposedly acted in, and talking about cell phones killing you. And it's just like, that scene is just so good. But everything in this movie is so good. A true classic.
You sound like you're from London.
You sound like you're from London.
Is that a line for the
Russell
movie?
Brand?
Should I watch this movie?
Have you not seen?
I have seen it, and I didn't. God. I didn't really care for it when I saw it. That's why I'm so amazed that you can be so invested in this throwaway movie.
I have said on the internet, where it is written in pen, written in ink, that Jason Segel making Forgetting Sarah Marshall when he was like 27 is the new Orson Welles making Citizen Kane.
Jesus.
It's been all downhill from there, but what a start. And
I guess what I've learned is that I didn't know we were in peak Mila Kunis until it was long gone.
Until it was over. Yeah, I mean, that movie was sort of peak everyone that was in it. Even Paul Rudd, who has been brilliant for so long and so many different things. It's for the sheer density of his brilliance in this movie is hard to compete with.
God, that is such a movie. There's definitely peak Russell. It was the beginning of Russell Brand, and also peak.
It's the alpha and omega of Russell Brand in a lot of ways.
I'm just scrolling through the IMDb page. I would argue it was not peak Bill Hader. I think he has only increased his stuff since then.
Bill Hader.
I don't think
we've
seen peak Bill Hader yet.
I hope not.
I would hope not.
And Jonah Hill got his Oscar nominations, too.
Jonah Hill
has two Oscar nominations.
Jonah Hill deserves an Oscar win for Forgetting Sarah Marshall as the waiter/resort employee. His line about letting Russell Brand listen to his demo and talking about how he's going to ignore him like everyone else in his life does. It's like... just immortal. I mean, this is a perfect film. It's one of the few. I can't recommend watching it between 50 and 100 times highly enough. I saw her with the black tongue tied around the roses. This time I know the vending machine.
Guys, I failed womankind by not seeing Wonder Woman this weekend because I was floating in a lake for a lot of the time, so I don't really have any regrets. But I want you guys to mansplain Wonder Woman to me.
This seems already dangerous.
It seems terrible.
I feel like
you've
put us in a very difficult spot by failing your gender.
I think we did some due diligence. We had Christy Petchko on last week, who is a super fan of the movie and also a great feminist writer on the internet. So she kind of spoke for, I think, a lot of the reaction of the movie, which has been women saying, we've been waiting forever for this. This movie is great. And lots of women are going to see it in big groups. And it obviously made a ton of money.
That's a good disclaimer. I just want to reiterate, like, Christy came on the show. She really led that conversation. And if you want to not hear three men talking at Katie, who hasn't seen the movie about Wonder Woman, please go listen
to
the
last episode. Katie asked for it. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I made my choice. But anyway, so I feel like the interesting thing about Wonder Woman, there's definitely some people who want to like it more than they did because of all the positive things that it stands for. There are people who flat out love it. And it feels like, in some ways, like Captain America, the First Avenger, where there are some people who think it's fine and then some people who adore it. Am I correct in reading it that it's like a perfectly competent movie and your level of affection for it just kind of depends on a really personal choice?
Yes.
Yeah, but I do think that it does the gender reversal element, which is so central to the movie's success and why I think people are rallying around it, very, very, very well.
In that Chris Pine is kind of the wide-eyed assistant to the superhero as opposed to a woman.
Yes, and there are all these familiar tropes and all these emotional beats and scenes that we've seen so many times from the other perspective that are flipped really incisively and perfectly, and that both of the actors, Gal Gadot and Chris Pine, really lean into and make a meal of. And, you know, the movie gets bogged down by so much superhero movie crap and so much DC
crap. Yeah, that's the problem. There's not enough of this great chemistry between the two of them.
But that stuff, like, and which is so key to the movie's success and existence, is pulled off immaculately. And before we start shitting on the movie, that shouldn't be overlooked.
Hey, who's going to shit on the movie?
Recently. I don't really know what you think about it at all.
I saw it today. It's definitely my favorite DCEU film.
But I'm that is say, damning with faint praise, let's be clear. Because
he's
talking about
further,
all
say,
of the DC movies.
Yeah, it's like
ever.
Tied with The Dark Knight. For
including
like,
Green Lantern.
In terms of, like, you know, well, definitely better than Green Lantern. I could not go out on a limb at all and say that. The reason I would say it's like Dark Knight status is I do think that The Dark Knight's a better movie, but in terms of representing your characters to like a modern audience in a single movie package, I feel like Wonder Woman does this amazing job of doing origin, but not making her specific enough that she could be like universal and in a world that was built on all these heroes rejecting their call to heroism. She's constantly wondering why she can't save everybody and insisting that, of course you can, like, thinking that you can't is like some sort of weird mental defeat that she has none of. So I like that the DC characters in general, because they can be that big, you know, Superman can turn back the globe and Batman can invent something that can outsmart Superman. Like, those are all interesting to me, but they've so often in recent movies have gotten bogged down with some sort of angst or parental issue that it's so nice to see like a traditional good for the sake of being good because that's why she exists hero, I guess, sort of come to the screen. And I think that's why Wonder Woman's going to end up being okay. Like I was saying last week, this is going to be really important to a certain group of people. And I think even as the DCEU gets all, you know, messed up in Justice League, Wonder Woman's going to be able to preserve itself as a very important movie to the people it speaks to.
Do you think that the forthcoming Justice League and Wonder Woman's presence in it is going to complicate any of this? Like, is she going to fit in with all of these dour, mean superheroes?
I mean, she's already the best part of the last time it did,
yeah.
So I'm hoping,
she's
like,
she's barely in it. I mean, as Wonder Woman, like, she shows up just to make you wish you were watching a different movie.
My hope is that they keep her out of this whole, like, overplot, whatever the plot of Justice League is. Like, I don't care. I don't care about Batman's vision. I don't care about Superman's resurrection, at least as far as the team goes. If the team operates like, you know, the team operated in Avengers in a way that makes sense and that has a beginning, middle, and end for each of them, then we'll be okay. I'm not more worried about Wonder Woman now, having seen it. I'm more like, if just give her two awesome moments and I'll fill in the rest. Like, you don't need to explain to me she's still good.
And that's what Gal Gadot is very good at. She is really tough. She's really passionate in silent battle moments, or when she's staring off into no man's land during World War I. I find her actual dialogue and acting skills to be kind of lackluster, and she doesn't have a ton of lines in this movie, frankly, because she's this fish out of water and she's walking through war-torn London, or even when she's on what is her island,
Themyscira.
She's watching the other Amazons fight, or she's watching her mother butt heads with her trainer, played by Robin Wright, who is amazing in this movie for a short amount of time. She's just so intense and so powerful, and she has this kind of Shakespearean way of speaking this nonsense. And Gal Gadot is, her job is to kind of stand there and take it all in, and these big eyes and looking around at the world. But then third act of the movie gives her a bit more dialogue to speak, and it was like listening to someone recite the spoken word sections of Celine Dion love ballads. The dialogue is horrible, and Gal Gadot cannot make it triumphant. It's a very strange, sad ending to this story.
It's her fault, I think.
I'm saying in the context of the movie, her dialogue readings, they do not work for me as much as her ferociousness when encountering a battle, or even looking at Steve Trevor and like feeling romance. There's this kind of like silent sex scene in the middle of the movie that is very, I don't know, it's very sensual. They connect and they close the door and it's cold and they get warm together. Ooh la la.
The third act is garbage. It's, I mean, the dialogue she's given is pretty atrocious. The way that they handle the villain is kind of, I mean, like, I was actually laughing in large part because of the casting choice, but and just like some of the visual choices that were made to bring that particular character to life. But I did like, I mean, and a lot of that is sort of part and parcel with what we accept superheroes to be. I mean, I do think a lot of the praise is qualified because we don't, because the bar has been lowered so much and because we've sort of been bludgeoned into accepting a certain framework of superhero narratives and the way these stories are structured. But I really did love how they didn't focus on her powers. I mean, it was really about her. We still don't really have a clear sense of what she's capable of. She doesn't really know what she's capable of in this movie. They don't belabor, you know, can her skin stop bullets? Can she fly? Can she do this? It's just sort of about her finding her way. And
stop what's that? Bullets. I don't think her skin can stop bullets.
Well, she has those things on her wrist, which I guess can stop bullets. But I don't know the first thing about Wonder Woman. So I was sort of learning along with this. I didn't know if she could. And so it was nice for me when she jumps long distances. I was like, oh, I feel like I'm learning that she can do that along with her because she was growing up on this island there. Her powers were unclear. And I thought the stuff they whenever the movie was focused on her character, her agency, her place in this world, I thought it was head and shoulders above what we've come to expect from DCU, and really just sort of like good for humanity on the whole. I mean, it's hard to, I have my issues with this movie and with a lot of these kinds of movies, but I really have felt that this weekend in particular. It's the way, not just the lip service this movie pays to a long underrepresented group, but the way in which it goes beyond that, in which like actually serves them. It gives them these images. It believes in them. It adds life to them. It gives them strength. I mean, I think it's a real good.
But I mean, yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying, but on some level, the movie is still, like, I'm still waiting for the great female-led superhero movie or the great female action blockbuster after Wonder Woman. This is an acceptable step.
Fury Road is a great example, David.
Yeah, there was an article in the Hollywood Reporter today that was like, can Wonder Woman finally be the popcorn movie that gets Oscar attention? I'm like, we are like,
wait, really?
2 years removed from Fury Road getting a zillion Oscar nominations. What? How short are our memories?
But yeah, the I like
the more, but like the more of this that has to get to the point where, sorry, Katie, it has to get to the point where, and I said this about Ghostbusters last year, where every one of these movies that is driven by every blockbuster that is female driven, made by women, starring women, we were not going to have progress until they're all not seen as referendums on the idea of having women behind the camera or women in front of the camera. We have to get to the point where they're allowed to be bad and we're still guaranteed to have more of them.
Yeah.
Like that, and only that's the only time it's going
to
be.
But that's what pains me about Wonder Woman a little bit, that it still seems to be suffocated by the DCU, the larger universe. You know, it's bookended by Gal Gadot in the Diana in the modern setting. It's actually Bruce Wayne who kind of ignites this. The movie is one long flashback that will lead up to her involvement in, maybe it's a prequel to Batman v Superman. Dave, I feel like you'll know this, but if it's not, then it's set up for Justice League.
He knows that the picture is an original, so it's a setup for Justice League.
Gotcha. So, I mean, there's still, that's surrounding it in some way. The actual flashback and her adventure during World War I is very much in a vacuum, but it still has the instincts of some of these Zack Snyder movies. And what's I want to know what you guys think about weaving World War I into her framework, a very real event, and they attempt to try and make it very realistic and kind of grim at certain points. Well, World War I, it doesn't take much to make World War I really grim, because people all over Europe are being killed, and there's, you know, she travels through no man's land and is being blown to bits by German warfare, and it's just like, it's really, there's mustard gas, people are dying, it's really depressing, and like, even the heroes in the movie are suffering from PTSD from their wartime experiences. Like, this is a harrowing event that now Wonder Woman is there and she's saving the day, and I thought it was slightly different than what we see in something like Captain America the First Avenger, where yes, it's set during World War II, but instead of Hitler and the Nazis, he's fighting this kind of like very fantastical side group that even the Nazis hate, the Red Skull and Hydra. It's totally removed from the war. It just takes the war imagery and throws Captain America into it. This is the actual World War I events being influenced by Wonder Woman and her saving the day, and these triumphant moments that, I mean, I'm not saying it needs to be historically accurate. I just think it's an interesting rework of history, and it left me a little unsettled at times.
I mean, I like it because I feel like this Wonder Woman movie feels like what I would think about if like a comic book serial is. So there's definitely three stories in this movie. She's tried to get to Ares throughout the whole thing, but you could, you know, plop it out in three little chunks and sort of see how like Wonder Woman could have been a trilogy about her getting to the war front. But it also takes like what we are definitely in World War One, and we do sort of stop the war, but really they kind of like push it aside to be about like this gas thing. And because of that, I feel like we're not exactly with Diana. We get to be an observer to Diana's discovery. So when she's like the first time in like the first, you know, 30 minutes of the movie is like, I'll go kill Ares, and then all the Germans will realize that they've been being bad and like stop. Like, the audience laughs because they're supposed to, because it's like, oh, Diana, you don't know how the world works. And so I think they managed to like balance that. There's not part of it to me that really feels exploitative to the World War One specifically, because I think that we're seeing it from like that fish out of water thing, and that her conclusion doesn't ask us to evaluate the war anymore.
Well,
than
except
one side's war and one side's love.
I don't know how spoilery we want to get, but in the end, there are definitely Germans hugging, you know, British soldiers, and everything is hunky dory because of what Wonder Woman does, and it's almost like, will World War II happen? Is it canonically written out thanks to the events of Wonder Woman? It's an odd conclusion to that whole thing.
I think it's an interesting nod to rooting a superhero in something that people can, you know, realize where the bar of realness is, which I think is why originally superheroes were inserted into war, is to make us see something amazing in something that was horrible. But yeah. I don't know.
I think it's stuck between the two worlds, because like when she goes to London, you get a taste of the period and life during war in a place far away from the battlegrounds. And maybe we could have used a little more time there. I wanted to see her explore and get a sense of this world that she's never known, because she's lived in this mystical place, this beautiful world. And now she's surrounded by the grays and blues of and the disgustingness of London. And even she's like sneering at it because it's so gross. But you don't really – it's not tangible until she goes to – the front lines, and my God, it's like really violent. I mean, she kills many people during this movie, and her compatriots kill many people, and it's quite violent. And I don't know if the movie totally reckons with the fact that it's fantasy, but it's gritty realism, and it's stuck in between the two because it can't devote the amount of time that it needs to comment on either. I don't know.
Go ahead, Katie,
as someone again who hasn't seen it, the idea that it's connected to World War One as opposed to them having to event some huge cataclysmic event with a spaceship hovering over a city, that feels really smart to me. Just to give an event with stakes that doesn't involve the same goddamn thing.
Except the special effects of the movie teeter on the edge of terribleness often that it's like Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow, but real.
The ending has real problems.
A cheesy Saturday morning serial feel to the movie. I mean, they're from the beginning on the island to just the way that the whole thing is presented. I mean, there is sort of a Sky Captain vibe to it, if that's what we want to call draw as our reference point. But so part of me wants to excuse the spectacular awfulness of the special effects as an extension of that. But in that case, the movie probably shouldn't have leaned as heavily on the special effects during the third act as they do. I mean, what it seems like to me, and this is pure speculation, is that Warner Brothers did not give this movie the money that it needed to succeed because they, and this is really conjecture. I can't stand behind this, but I look at what you see on screen and I know what the budgets are for this movie relative to some of the bigger DC movies. And it just feels like they saw this as a second tier effort and didn't necessarily expect the sort of rapid enthusiasm the movie would have gotten. And I would imagine that you will not see this problem, any sort of corner cutting and cheapness in the sequels.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, so, the real special effect was love.
The real special effect is definitely love. love is what she uses to beat the bad guy. But you know, it's a good stuff.
Yeah, you just gotta spend some more money on that third act if you're gonna cast a villain that needs to be entirely CGI based on what you're setting up. Seems like a weird choice, but they're gonna walk into that trap in Justice League in a couple of months, so we'll see if they've learned how to handle it.
Oh my god, a couple of months. Really, you're right.
When is it?
November.
Oh fuck, really?
It's gonna be really interesting to see how, you know, compare the early trailers where it was like seven people and Wonder Woman was just one of them. To the marketing, I think it's going to come out down the pike where it's like Wonder Woman in Justice League with other
Wonder Woman shows up to save all the assholes.
Well, I'm sure Justice League will have a great female villain to add more female characters to the DCU. I'm sure that's going to be the case. I know Wonder Woman didn't really have a great
Steppenwolf a villain. People will really enjoy that.
Why don't any of the villains in Wonder Woman resonate? Why aren't any of them interesting? It's so sad. Like,
because it's
Dr. Maru character is awesome.
No, it's not about the villain. You don't want. You could have the Batman versus the Joker if people know who Batman and the Joker are. You can't start with that.
You're absolutely right. But she was a cool villain. This Dr. Maru who produces the mustard gas, and she's the woman from The Skin I Live In. And she's cool. Wait, oh yeah, she does live, but she's changed. Thus, I don't want to spoil the end.
No, she's just spared. You see Wonder Woman this weekend or week and tell us if she lives.
I'll do my best. That does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week recovering from David's wedding. One way or another, something will go on this feed, so it's likely to be one you don't want to miss. We don't know what it's going to involve, but hopefully some good stories and maybe some games. So anyway, David will be back after his honeymoon, so he won't be around for a while. But
yeah,
you know,
might be down to David for like a month.
Oh Lord,
3 weeks.
Well,
month. Probably.
I mean, when we got married, we skipped out for various periods, so can't resent him too much. Anyway, you know where to find him. How about everybody else? Where can we find you on the internet?
I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, as mentioned, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes. You can share them with friends, which you should definitely do. I'm sure you have a person who needs a movie podcast in their life that's about like yelling about Gul'dan and talking about Wonder Woman, which does not star a character named Gul'dan. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find us all on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. And, of course, my other podcast, Storm Spoilers, is back actually talking about Game of Thrones. You guys have certainly noticed, says the statistics. So continue to join us. It's season 3 this week. We've got an invitation for a wedding. Things are probably going to be fine.
It's going to go as better or worse than David's wedding.
Go. Oh, man. If anyone
starts playing
the Reigns of Castamere,
is it still not okay to make red wedding jokes?
I mean, it's very new for me. I have to talk about it again this week. I just watched it.
It's very fresh. David's wedding will be nothing like the red wedding. It'll be great. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on Twitter at Katie Rich. And please tweet at us at FITWR. I especially want to hear who you might want to hear as a guest to replace David while he is away getting married and stuff. Anyone besides Joanna. We know you want to hear more Joanna. That will probably happen. But anyone else who you would want to hear come back, you can probably have them step in for David. And then you can just tweet at us for whatever else and answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
Inspired by The Mummy, what monster joins Universal's Dark Universe, and who should play it or them?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you all in one room next week.
Let me princess print this. Let me princess print this.